least by that clock. All right. We'll go ahead and get started. Open your Bibles, book of Deuteronomy chapter 7. Deuteronomy chapter 7. It's late in the quarter. Gave up on finishing Joshua. Thought we'd just do something else. No. No, if you remember, if you were here last week, we were looking at a couple of things in Deuteronomy that are relevant to what we're about to read in Joshua. Help us understand a little bit more about what's going on in the next couple of chapters. Some law God through Moses had given the people as they went into the land, and so we want to make sure we know what they were told as we read about what they did. So, with that being said, let's start with a word of prayer. Can I get someone, a brother, to lead us in that? Someone want to volunteer and do that? Is that Bill? Thanks, Bill.
I'm embarrassed. Please bow with me. Holy Father, we are grateful that you brought us here together to not only praise your word, praise your name, glorify the mercy you have shown us. We pray, Father, always that your wisdom stay with us, your guidance light our way. We rejoice in your love. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. All right, a couple of places here in Deuteronomy 7 real quick. We read a little bit of this last week, but just to recap, and I know it's been 7 nights and you've slept 7 times since then. First paragraph of chapter 7, you with me there? Beginning of chapter 7. When the Lord your God brings you into the land that you are entering to take possession of it and clears away many nations before you, Hittites, Girgashites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, 7 nations more numerous and mightier than you. And when the Lord your God gives them over to you and you defeat them, then you must devote them to the complete destruction. Now notice it's the people, not every city. Jericho had to be destroyed as the first fruits. We talked about that. But while they didn't have to destroy every city they were going to take subsequently, the people were to be destroyed, right? You shall make no covenant with them. You shall show no mercy to them. Don't let them talk you out of this. And don't let you have a humanitarian moment and worry about war crimes in Nuremberg and decide not to do it. No. You will show no mercy. And you shall make no covenant with them. You shall not intermarry with them, giving your sons, your daughters to their sons, or taking their daughters for your sons. And the reason, verse 4, for they would turn your sons from following me to serve other gods, and then the anger of the Lord would be kindled against you, and he would destroy you quickly. But thus you shall deal with them. Not only shall you destroy them, but you shall break down their altars, dash in pieces their pillars, and chop down their Asherim, and burn their carved images with fire. And so that's why you were supposed to wipe it all out. And while you could keep the cities and the vineyards you haven't planted and all the other stuff, destroy all their religious leftovers, right? And of course, the whole book of Judges is going to be about what, you know, exactly what God warned them about, because they're not going to do some aspects of this, and thus the book of Judges happens. The other thing from this section, though, drop down verse 17. If you say in your heart, these nations are greater than I, how can I dispossess them? And have they done that before? Yeah, go back and read the book of Numbers, right? Very first time 12 spies spied out the land, they did this once. Now here they are, second generation, about to go in again. God says, let's not have a repeat, shall we? If you say in your heart, these nations are greater than I, how can I dispossess them? You shall not be afraid of them, but you shall remember what the Lord your God did to Pharaoh and to all Egypt, the great trials that your eyes saw, the signs, the wonders, the mighty hand, the outstretched arm by which the Lord your God brought you out. So will the Lord your God also do to the peoples of whom you are afraid. You know, and you were a little afraid in Egypt too, let's be honest. You know, Exodus records that, but he did it then, he will do it again, don't be afraid. Moreover, the Lord your God will send hornets among them until those who are left and hide themselves from you are destroyed. So even if they escape or think they've escaped, I'll providentially find them and I will deal with these peoples. Verse 21, you shall not be in dread of them, for the Lord your God is in your midst, a great and awesome God. The Lord your God will clear these nations away before you little by little, that you may not make an end of them at once, lest the wild beasts grow too numerous for you. But the Lord your God will give them over to you and throw them into great confusion. And there in verse 23, this idea of in great confusion. Keep that phrase or that idea. That's an easy phrase to skip over. But that's actually one of the tools in God's toolbox when he is judging a people or dealing with a people. He doesn't just always send lightning from heaven or strike people dead. He sows chaos among people. And so keep that idea, that phrase in mind as we go forward. About just as a quick, as a I scribbled this down somewhere. There it is. As a quick sidebar, actually, go back to Exodus, for instance. Exodus 14, I think it is. Quick example. Yep, there it is. Quick example, verse 24. And Exodus 14, verse 24, as Egypt, even after the death of the firstborn, after Israel is starting to leave the land, but they're backed up against the sea, and they think that they're trapped, and Pharaoh's army and chariots have pursued them. Look at how, let's see, verse 23, Egypt pursued and went in after them into the midst of the sea. I don't know about you, but after a God like this God has sent 10 plagues, done things my magicians and gods can't do, and then splits a sea, I'm going home. But they followed into the sea, staggering. All Pharaoh's horses, chariots, and horsemen. And in the morning watch, the Lord took the pillar of fire and cloud and looked down on the Egyptian forces. But look at what he did. He threw them into a panic. He sowed confusion among them. Nothing that, by the way, in and of itself necessarily had to be miraculous, except for maybe the timing, or ultimately the text wants us to know that God did this, clogging their chariot wheels so that they drove heavily. That's not lightning from heaven kind of stuff, right? That's no miraculous, you know, the wheels just disappeared, poof, they're gone. That's the way we usually think of when we think about miracle. The idea of God just providentially sowing chaos. You know, the wheels fell off at the perfect time in the perfect way, something that you might not have otherwise directly attributed to God, but I just thought, well, you know, somebody didn't tighten the lug nuts really well or something. But the reason it's in here is the text wants to make sure, no, that's actually God's hand in that God has a lot of tools in his toolbox, some obvious, like fire from heaven kind of stuff, some less obvious. But this is something God does. He sows or strews confusion in the situations, creates chaos as a way of disabling his enemies. And there's a number of other stories in the Old Testament where you'll see that at work. But just understand there in chapter 7, he says that's what's going on in Deuteronomy. I'm going to do that to them. There will be chaos. I will confuse them. All right. One other place in Deuteronomy, chapter 20. Chapter 20, one last place in which God talks to them about how they're going to conduct war when they go in the land. And I'm going to pick up chapter 20, verse 10. When you draw near to a city to fight against it, offer terms of peace to it. And if it responds to you peaceably and it opens to you, then all the people who are found in it shall do forced labor for you and shall serve you. But if it makes no peace with you, but makes war against you, then you shall besiege it. And when the Lord your God gives it into your hand, you shall put all males to the sword, but the women, the little ones, the livestock, and everything else in the city, all its spoil, you shall take as plunder for yourselves, and you shall enjoy the spoil of your enemies, which the Lord your God has given you. Thus you shall do to the cities that are very far from you, which are not cities of the nations here. And so what's he talking about? One of the things that we miss a lot of times is, and here's my really, this is not the scale. I thought that was funny. Because it's definitely not the scale. One of the things that we miss sometimes, and we talk about from time to time, and you got the Tigris and the Euphrates way over here, is that in your Bible maps, we talk about, you know, this is kind of the land of Israel. You got your 12 tribes in there. But what God actually gave to Abraham technically was basically from the river Euphrates all the way down to the Wadi El Arish, a little small little river before you get to the Nile. And so he gave him this huge swath that goes all the way into modern-day Iraq. If you're looking at a way of looking at it on a modern map, huge swath of land was technically theirs. And they will eventually come to possess all of it in the days of Solomon, eventually. And 1 Kings 4 makes explicit note of that they have finally, under the days of Solomon, come into their full Abrahamic inheritance. That was that little bit in chapter 7. I'm not going to give you all the land all at once. You can't possess it all now. But gradually you will. In the days of Solomon, it comes to pass. So that being said, there are going to be, but if this is their heartland, and it always was, right? This is where God parts the Jordan, they go in. This is where Gilgal is, Shechem. When, per Deuteronomy, God chooses a place to put his name, where the temple will be built, that's going to be Jerusalem. This is going to be their heartland. And so when the Deuteronomy starts talking about cities near versus cities far, I think what it means is the cities in the Canaanite heartland, i.e. what we're reading about in Joshua, those peoples are to be thoroughly destroyed. As you gradually expand, those cities far away, you don't have to be quite as draconian with. And that's what he's talking about here in chapter 20. That's what he means there, verse 15. Thus you shall do to all the cities that are very far from you, which are not cities of the nations here. In other words, not of those seven Hittite or seven Canaanite nations that he named, right? The Hittites, the Perizzites, Jebusites, Hivites. I'm repeating myself. You get the point. Those people have to be destroyed. But as you expand in time, you don't have to be as draconian with those other cities. You could offer them peace. If they surrender, you turn them into forced labor. But if they resist you, then slaughter the males and take what you can afterwards. Verse 16, but in the cities of these people, the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance, you shall save alive nothing that breathes, but you shall devote them to complete destruction, just like we saw in chapter 7. The Hittites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites, as the Lord your God has commanded, that they may not teach you to do according to all their abominable practices that they have done for their gods, and so you sin against the Lord your God. All right, so those are the basic rules, right? Cities nearby, slaughter everybody. You can keep the spoils, but make sure you destroy all their pagan stuff. Cities far away, you can offer them peace. If they surrender, you've got forced labor. If they don't, slaughter the males, keep whatever you can of the rest. That's the basic rules, all right? So back to Joshua. Back to Joshua, chapter 9. Beginning in verse 1. How many of you have read or heard of the story of the Gibeonites before, just out of curiosity? Some? Do what now? Maybe. Joshua 9. As soon as all the kings who were beyond the Jordan in the hill country, then the lowland and all along the coast of the great sea toward Lebanon, so that'd be all these folks over here too, although towards Tyre.
Oh, our bread's all crusty.
This is that story. Yeah, that's it. So, but there was a spoiler alert there. they gathered together as one to fight against Joshua and Israel. So basically, the cities and the peoples of the region realize city by city they're going to pick us off. If we're going to do anything about this or any hope of resisting, we need to kind of combine forces. And by the way, you got to understand, in that world, that really is some doing, because they were more like city-states back then, right? Normally these cities would fight against each other, these various Canaanite cities. And so, but they realized that the only prayer they have, pardon the pun, against Israel is to band together this time, form an alliance, and fight together as one against them. But, verse 3, when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, they on their part acted with cunning. Oh, that's an interesting word. And went out and made ready provisions, took worn-out sacks for their donkeys and wineskins, and worn-out and torn and mended with worn-out patched sandals on their feet, worn-out clothes. All their provisions were dry and crumbly, and they went to Joshua in the camp at Gilgal. Now, you have to understand, Gibeon's only a few miles away in reality. If you don't have your key map out or Google Maps, Gibeon is only a few miles away. So that word cunning matters. In other words, they are doing this intentionally, right? They are intentionally trying to make it look like they have been on the road for years. It's like, putting bald tires on your car and, old oil in the engine and not washing your clothes for 3 weeks and making sure the kids are screaming and crying when you get there. All right. Because that's what a little... That's what a road trip looks like. Come on. And so they come to Joshua at Gilgal, which is in fact only a few miles away from Gibeon. We have come from a distant country, so now make a covenant with us. But the men of Israel said to the... Oh, and look what the Gibeonites really are. In fact, they are... What are they? Hivites. Is Hivites on that list of the seven? Yeah, they are. They're on that list. They're on the do not fly list. Perhaps you live among us. Then how can we make a covenant with you? That's the correct answer. That's the Deuteronomy 7, Deuteronomy 20 answer. We can't make a covenant with you if you're from close by. And they said, from a very distant country your servants have come because of the name of the Lord your God. For we have heard a report of him and all that he did in Egypt and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, Sihon of Heshbon and Og of Bashan, who lived in Ashtaroth. And so our elders and all the inhabitants of our country said to us, take provisions in your hand for the journey and go and meet them and say to them, we are your servants. come now, make a covenant with us. And it's almost like they knew the rules of Deuteronomy 20. If you're from a faraway city, can we do this? Yes, you can. And so what do they claim to be? From a faraway city. And what do they want? A covenant of peace. We surrender. We don't want any trouble. And so in that sense, can they ask, or can they ask for terms of peace from Israel? Yes, they can. It's almost like they read Deuteronomy 2. And so they say everything right per Deuteronomy 20.
Are they pardoned of the Gibeonite blood? You know, like the way they made the covenant with Rahab and said, okay, we'll protect you and your family.
Mm-hmm.
And then here comes this whole people, and they're supposed to destroy them, but
yeah.
The people tricks them. So,
yep.
Is God holding them responsible?
So let's hold on to that. Let's come back to that. Let's finish the story and let's actually ask that question. Because
okay.
I think that's part of what the story teases at. Picking it back up, let's see, in verse 12. Yeah, here is our bread. It was still warm when we took it from our houses as food for the journey on the day we set out to come to you. But now, behold, it is dry and crumbly. These wineskins were new when we filled them. Behold, they have burst. All these garments and sandals of ours are worn out from the very long journey. And so the men took some of their provisions, but did not ask counsel from the Lord. Hold on to that. And Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them to let them live, and the leaders of the congregation swore it to them. At the end of 3 days, after they had made a covenant with them, then they heard that they were neighbors and that they lived among them. Well, that's awkward. And all the people of Israel set out and reached their cities on the third day. Now, their cities were Gibeon and several others, because these were actually Hivites. And the people of Israel did not attack them. Why? Well, because the leaders of the congregation had sworn to them by the Lord, the God of Israel. And so once you invoke God's name, that kind of puts God's name on the deed, on the covenant too. And now you got a real awkward situation. Because on the one hand, God's commandment was, destroy these people and don't make a covenant with them. On the other hand, you've sworn by the name of God itself that you're not going to kill them. Oh, man, that's why people go to law school for 3 years. What do you do with this? Well, let's keep reading. So all the leaders said to the congregation, verse 18, but the people of Israel did not attack them because the leaders of the congregation sworn by the Lord. Then all the congregation murmured against the leaders. Isn't that how it always works? You know, you vote for them, and then 6 months later, you're grumbling. But all the leaders said to the congregation, we have sworn to them by the Lord, the God of Israel, and now we may not touch them. This we will do to them, lest let them live, lest wrath be upon us because of the oath that we swore to them. You know. And the leaders said to them, let them live, since they became cutters of wood and drawers of water for all the congregation. In other words, they put them to forced labor. They treated them exactly like people from a distant city who had surrendered and had a covenant with him, right? They did the best application of the law as it stood that they could. If we entered into this relationship with them on the idea that they are distant people, we will treat them then as distant people who made peace with us. But they do not believe that they can break their covenant that they have made, especially because, as the text keeps repeating, they made the covenant in the name of God, which is actually a form of taking God's name in vain. It's not just cussing, folks. It's when you use the name of God in ways that invoke God or involve God and get God's hands dirty in something, and God would rather not be a part of it. And so that's the conundrum. That's what they do. And so verse 22, Joshua summoned them, and he said to them, why did you deceive us? Go all the way back. That word we saw early in the chapter, that word was cunning. And by the way, part of, you know, as we work on our Bible reading skills, you know, and words matter, and sometimes the story, the way the story is told to us, is dropping hints. Can you think of another story that begins with somebody was very cunning? Yeah, that's how Genesis 3 starts, right? What's the first thing? What's the first line in Genesis 3? And the serpent was more cunning than the other beasts of the field. And how did that story turn out? Yeah, things didn't exactly get done God's way in that story either, did they? Right. Oh, I know I should have looked this up before class. I believe it is. I will correct myself with dust and ashes and sackcloth and great humiliation next week. I think it is. But if not, the concept is there regardless. It is meant to be a clue at the beginning that something's a little screwy.
So the fact that the covenant was based on false information given them does not, in effect, make the covenant.
You'll see. So see that's where we got to play this a little bit. Yeah, Anthony, you want to jump in? Right.
God brought this back up.
Absolutely right.
This covenant with them.
That's right.
So,
that's exactly right.
Even with that,
right.
You made it, you're going to live by it.
Yeah. The only place that I can think of in the Bible that God greenlights the breaking of a covenant or an oath that has been made is back in the Pentateuch when a wife or a daughter make some sort of covenant or oath that her husband or father, depending on which she is, does not know about. And when that woman's husband or father, depending on which status she's in, finds out about it, he has the option of annulling it with no consequences, because as the head of that woman, whether it's husband or father, that makes us uncomfortable these days, right? Because we're in a more egalitarian society. But God saw men as the heads of their families, whether as fathers or husbands. And so when the husband or father found out, he was allowed to annul his wife's covenant or oath, and there would be no consequences for it. Though the text also makes very clear that if he does not annul it at the time he finds out about it, he can't retroactively do it, 6 months later or whatever. Now you're back into the classic. In fact, here, to Anthony's point about, that's right, that one of the key stories to help us interpret this is Saul with Gibeon down the road. But go with me, Psalm 15. Couple other observations we can bring to bear on this as we think through the mess that they made here of the situation. Psalm 15. I like this little psalm. It's a little, just tell me what I have to do to go to heaven kind of psalm. As preachers, we always kind of cringe when people ask us, just what do I have to do to be saved, in the sense of, it almost sounds like it's a checklist or a bare minimum. But this is one of those little psalms that's kind of what it's doing, actually. It's, O Lord, who shall sojourn in your tent? Who shall dwell on your holy hill? Who gets to live with God forever? And it's really just kind of a list of a whole lot of things. Most of them would make perfect sense, standard moral kind of stuff. But look with me, second half of verse 4. Look at this line. The one, who does God accept? Who does God want? The one who swears to his own hurt and what? And does not change. What does that mean? Part of the risk of making a covenant or taking an oath is what? Especially if it's something that really matters in life. Yeah, and you may not realize it till later. And these days, what do? We get our legal team together and figure out how much it's going to cost us to break this contract. However, the traditional wedding vows, because that's probably one of the most common covenants oaths that we swear to this day, not these modern mushy, Hallmark style wedding vows that people choose, but the classic, the stuff that back when we were more serious about things, rather than say yes to the dress about too many weddings these days. What were the classic vows?
For better or for worse, till death do you part.
In sickness and in health, for richer, for poorer, till death do you part. In other words, I don't know what entering this marriage may cost me yet. We have dreams of having kids, and one of us finds out we're infertile or sterile. A woman has dreams of being a stay-at-home mom, but her husband is crippled in an accident and can't work, and so now she has to leave home and help provide. You have no idea, ultimately, over the course of 50 years, or whether you even get 50 years for that matter, what's going to happen. But regardless of whatever happens in that marriage, what are you committing to? I'll bear any burden, I'll pay any price, this is the commitment I make. I swear to my own hurt, and I do not change. I remember years ago, when I was actually about Hunter's age, and that was a church I was working with, preached a sermon, used Psalm 15. One of the members came up to me afterwards. He was the CEO of a large regional healthcare corporation that you would have heard of in that part of the country. and he was a member with us. And he comes up to me afterwards. He was curious. I didn't say anything about that particular phrase, and he asked me about it. And I said, well, this is, you know, what it means. You bottom line is you make a deal, and you find out later that deal's going to cost you more than you thought. You keep your word anyways. And so he means kind of like a, and so he says to me, he says, you mean it's kind of like a friend of mine one time, you know, he made some sort of deal and found it was going to cost him an extra $1 million, and he kept his word. And I said, yep, that's just exactly what it means, just like as we all deal with from day to day. That's the world he lived in. But the point was, he got the point. Everybody in your world, however big or small the numbers may be, so to speak, you swear to your own hurt and do not change. Other stories that drive this point home, by the way, and I'll take questions and comments. I think Jephthah. Jephthah's story, right? Same kind of situation. Reckless oath taken. But then here's the thing. Did God hold up his end of the bargain? Yes, he did. Did Jephthah need a lawyer to look over that contract before he made it? Yeah, as we work our way back to this story, that's why that line is added as well. They did not consult the Lord. By the way, even short of, you know, God directly speaking from a cloud or you know, sending a prophet, did they in that era have ways in which they could even ask God simple yes and no questions? Of course they did. What do they have? They could cast lots, but especially they had a high priest who had what? The Urim and the Thummim. And what were those specifically purposed for? So that you could inquire of the Lord what he wants you to do. And that, again, I think is why that line is in there. But once it is made, the text seems to indicate God expects them, because they used his name. They invoked God's name as guarantor of this. Okay, let me get Yvette, and then I'll come up to Jeff. Oh, there. Oh, I'm sorry. So, yeah, no, that's right. That's right. And by the way, sometimes people sit there and they say, you know, but God's not okay with human sacrifice or what? I mean, why would he? Yes, but that's not what God agreed to as such. That's just the recklessness of Jephthah and the foolishness of the way he dealt with things. He should not have been so reckless with his mouth in the first place. Yeah, Jeff.
Well, even if he didn't have to keep that covenant, there was another Israelite law where they weren't supposed to kill their own children.
He
could have opposed.
He was in a no-win situation is the problem.
I think he himself was afraid of what God might do to him if he didn't keep his word or whatever. But I think it's mostly about integrity of people and responsibility. Because you think about it, the only part of Scripture that's not inspired would be the Ten Commandments, which it's not inspired because it was written by God himself. And when people think about Ten Commandments, they think about thou shalt not and thou shalt. Mm-hmm. But it's really the most important the most important word in those commandments is not shout and shout not. The most important word is thou.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's because you are my people, therefore I have certain expectations of you. Mm-hmm. I have delivered you out of the land of slavery, out of Egypt. It was a suzerain treater. I have done this for you, therefore you shall
right.
do this.
Obligation.
And so, in the suzerain, it wasn't just like a parity treaty we'd have between equals. It was
suzerain
was the Lord of lords.
That's right.
And it's always presented in the format, I've done this for you, therefore I expect you to do this. I expect you, thou,
right.
to be this kind of people to have integrity.
So that's right.
It's also, you know, no accident that, like when a man raped a woman, the penalty was to take an oath and to marry her. Say, okay, well, the penalty, now that you've raped her, you're going to have to take her as your own wife and
take responsibility for what you've done.
You know,
sure.
Integrity.
No, that's right. So the story gives hints that all was not right. It was cunning. They didn't ask counsel of the Lord. But now they have to keep the word, so they follow the rest of Deuteronomy 20 as best they can and treat them according to what a faraway city would have had done. Why? Well, you know, before we talk about why this story, why tell us this story? You know, all these other cities that they're going to conquer. You know, Gibeon really wasn't that important of a city strategically anyways. You know, what's interesting is when you get into chapter 10 and 11, as the book of Joshua wraps up the stories of conquest, in terms of actually strategically significant cities like Hatzor up in the north, the text is going to tell us almost nothing about how they took that city, even though that's, you know, if you ever go on a trip to Israel to this day, you're going to discover, you know, as you're doing your tour, Hatzor was, you know, and you can go see the ruins of it. It was a major city. Did y'all get over there, Jade, when y'all went? Didn't get to go up to Hatzor? You know, we still got the Solomonic gates because Solomon fortified the city because it was like a key defensive city in that region in the northern part of the land. You know, the text will tell us almost nothing about major cities they go on to take. It focuses on stories like this. And the question is why? Come back to that in a minute. Set to the side for a minute, though. Let's go a little bit further. Let me just finish reading the paragraph in verse 22, and then we need to look at chapter 10 and see what happens. Because Gibeon is not, the story of Gibeon is not done when this chapter is done. Joshua summoned them and said, "Why did you deceive us?" Well, I can answer that. They didn't want to die. Saying, "We are very far from you when you dwell among us. Now, therefore, you are cursed." We can't take away the whole, "We cannot wholesale destroy you now like other inhabitants of the land." We can't take that away, but still, we can curse you in other ways. "And so some of you shall never be anything but servants, cutters of wood, drawers of water for the house of my God." Then they answered Joshua, "Because it was told to your servants for a certainty that the Lord your God had commanded his servant Moses to give you all the land and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land from before you. So we feared greatly for our lives because of you and did this thing. And now behold, we are in your hand. Whatever seems good and right in your sight to do to us, do it." And so he did this to them and delivered them out of the hand of the people of Israel. They did not kill them, but Joshua made them that day cutters of wood, drawers of water for the congregation, for the altar of the Lord to this day, and the place that he should choose, because it hasn't been named yet. Eventually it will be Jerusalem. And by the way, as a sidebar, the emphasis there upon, especially for God's house. Remember back in Deuteronomy 7, in wiping out the closest cities of the heartland of the land God was giving them, the reason was they were haram, right? It was dedicated to God, devoted to destruction, but in the sense of dedicated to God. So since we can't kill them, how else can you leave them devoted to God? They will literally serve in the temple or the tabernacle when we have it. They're not even just meant to be kind of forced labor for everybody, but they will directly serve God since they dared to trick us into swearing an oath in his name. And so they will directly serve God accordingly. One of the things you do, by the way, before we turn to chapter 10 and look at the rest of the story of Gibeon as the book of Joshua tells it, one of the things you have to give him credit for, even just looking at that little speech they gave when Joshua says, "Why'd you do this?" Do they believe, do they seem to sincerely have faith in the God of Israel? That word "certainly" is kind of a clue, isn't it? They were believers. Who else in this book has talked like that? Rahab. Yeah, there's Rahab. Rahab has. And Rahab got to, in the lineage of Jesus, she got to live. And obviously, and eventually, ultimately turns out to be married into Israel and is incorporated into the Messiah's lineage. But got to live. And so again, maybe, in God's providence, it's not one of those, it turns what, the mistake Joshua and the leaders made into being right. But just like Joseph could say at the end of Genesis, "What you meant for evil, God used for good." Same type of thing here, where their faith in a roundabout way still winds up being recognized, and they do get to live, just like Rahab did. Because unlike the other Canaanite cities, remember, beginning of the chapter, what were the other Canaanite cities doing? They were forming the Canaanite version of NATO, is what they were doing. They were banding together, mutual defense. So here's the thing, chapter 10, verse 1. Pretend that chapter break's not there. Chapter breaks are almost always in the wrong places. This is part of the story still. "As soon as Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, heard how Joshua had captured Ai and devoted to destruction, doing to Ai and its king as he had done to Jericho and its king, and how the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace with Israel and were now among them." Again, who's this guy? King of Jerusalem. Because it's not an Israelite hand. It's not going to be an Israelite hand for several centuries yet. But it was still a chief city. It's always been a chief city in that part of the world. So its king is kind of the bigger king among a lot of other lesser kings of other smaller cities in the region. And when he recognizes what's happened in Jericho and Ai already, and that Gibeon, rather than joining the alliance, has made peace with Israel, he feared greatly, because Gibeon was a great city, like one of the royal cities, and because it was greater than Ai, which isn't hard to do, Ai wasn't big, and all its men were warriors. So not only have they kind of betrayed us and stabbed us in the back, but we just lost an important source of military help. And so Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, sent to Hoham, king of Hebron, and Pithom, king of Jarmuth, and Japhia, king of Lachish, and to Dever, king of Eglon, saying, come up to me and help me. Let us strike, not Israel, who are they going to get? Gibeon. For it has made peace with Joshua and with the people of Israel. And then the five kings of the Amorites, the king of Jerusalem, king of Hebron, king of Jarmuth, king of Lachish, the king of Eglon, gathered their forces and went up with all their armies and encamped against Gibeon and made war against it. And since the Gibeonites were mighty warriors by other Canaanites' own admission, they fought back valiantly. Is that what happens? Yeah, they put this new covenant they've got, this shiny new covenant to the test. Don't you hate it when somebody joins NATO and they're the first ones to call out for help? That's just, man, they haven't paid their first year's dues yet. The men of Gibeon sent to Joshua at the camp in Gilgal and said, do not relax your hand from your servants. Come up to us quickly and save us and help us, for all the kings of the Amorites who dwell in the hill country are gathered against us. And by the reference to the hill country is important, because what's really about to happen here, again, is fascinating where the book of Joshua chooses to place emphasis versus if you were Herodotus or some sort of ancient secular history writer, how you would choose to tell the story. Because the central highlands in Jerusalem's kind of down here in the southern part of that. That's where they've been so far. Jericho's around the edge. Ai is kind of up here. Gerizim and Ebal are up there. Gibeon's kind of over in here somewhere. And so these kind of central highlands is what they've been taking. And so this actually gift wraps the rest of that for Israel, because they all come together as they're fighting against Gibeon. That makes it easy for Israel rather than going city by city to do what? Destroy all their forces in one place. It's one-stop shopping. How convenient. And then all they have to do, and this is what's really just kind of the rest of chapter 10, 11, and 12, 10 and 11, is they just wipe out the south and they wipe out the north, which are actually more involved than you would think, but the Bible's not emphasizing that. The Bible's emphasizing stories that help us understand God's work in Israel. This is not a bona fide military history. This is meant to help us understand the nature of God and his work, which is why the Gibeon story matters. And we'll talk about that more in a sec. Let's finish the actual what happens. Because what happens is one of the greatest but most quickly forgotten miracles in all the Bible, is what happens. So Joshua went up from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him, all the mighty men of valor. And the Lord said to Joshua, oh look, God's back involved, this is going to end better. Lord said to Joshua, do not fear them, for I have given them into your hands. And by the way, why would Joshua be tempted to fear? We've had these kind of speeches before, but it's been a while. Why would Joshua be back to being tempted to fear? So that's part of it, you know, maybe second-guessing himself, and so he needs a clear word from God to kind of, you know, make sure we're doing the right thing. What's the other aspect? You know, Jericho was one thing. Yeah, it was one thing. This is something different. This is literally the remaining strength of an entire region amassed. And Israel hasn't fought this kind of battle yet. And have people died already? Has kind of the innocence been removed? Can you die doing this? Yes, you can. And by the way, part of what we did not read, but you can go back and read on your own tonight, when you go back to read Deuteronomy chapter 20, first part of Deuteronomy chapter 20, when Israel musters its armies for battle, it's interesting in the text. God will say on the one hand, do not fear, I am with you. But then a couple verses later, if any of you have, you know, built a new house and not lived in it yet, or betrothed a wife and not married her yet, and several other things, what should you do? Should you go to the battle? No, you should go back and finish whatever it is. Why? No, that's not what it says. Because you could die. Wait, I thought God said, don't fear, I'm with you. See, it's actually even in Israel's own battles when God is fighting for them, it's rare that a battle is fought where nobody dies. And now you're back to even the Old Testament version of how can God tell us he's with us and yet still let bad things happen to us? That imponderable conundrum of the way of God with men. Nothing new about that. Nothing New Testament about that. Here he is in Israel on the one hand saying, don't be afraid when you go to battle. I'm with you. Oh, you can still die anyways, by the way. Because in fact, one of the things on the list is, and if any of you are scared of this, basically, if you're faint-hearted, you also stay home because I don't want that fear spreading through the rest of the troops. Yes, ma'am? Correct. Correct. And that's the key is, and this is one of the most important things in the Bible to understand, the way God talks to the group versus individual circumstances within the group, right? All right. Yeah, Anthony? That's right. That's right. And that's the thing is ultimately, you know, there is that whole for the people of God, there is a different perspective on that. That's right. And even by the way there, you know, the reason the exemptions besides just the one who's just too fearful and we don't want you part of the demoralizing everybody, it's because you have legitimate things in life to do yet. You know, it's one of those classic, you know, one of the reasons, you know, as a Christian, in one sense, you say, yes, I'm always ready to die and go and be with the Lord. That'd be far better. I'm very Paul, Philippians 1-ish. But at the same time, you know, you're a young father. Is there a sense in which you don't want to die, not just because I'm scared of death, but because I feel like I have children to raise, a wife to provide for, my life insurance policy is even fully vested yet? I mean, you get what I'm saying? You know, there is a reason to not want to die yet, because not so much for selfish or even self-oriented reasons, I haven't been to Disney World yet. I gotta see the Grand Canyon before I die. But because I have legitimate things in life that are worth doing for others' benefit, and so it's better that I not die yet. You with me? That makes sense? But yeah, this whole dynamic of the group versus the individual, we say a lot more about that. We're out of time. See you next week.